Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 7, Discourse Number 7.
Bhagwan, silence cannot make a master out of a fool, but he who weighs only purity in his scales, who sees the nature of the two worlds, he is a master. He harms no living thing. And yet it is not good conduct that helps you upon the way, nor ritual, nor book learning, nor withdrawal into the self, nor deep meditation. None of these confers mastery or joy. O seeker, rely on nothing until you want nothing.
Silence has been pressed down the ages as one of the most important factors for inner transformation. But silence alone is neither enough nor beneficial. Silence alone can be tremendously harmful. Silence alone is a negative state. It can make you more dead than you are. It can destroy the joy of inner being. It can be an obstruction into the growth of a celebrating soul. Silence is beautiful only if it is rooted in awareness. If it is not rooted in awareness, then it is utterly empty. With awareness, silence has a depth, a plenitude, a fulfillment, a contentment, an overflowing joy. With awareness, silence blooms, releases great fragrance. Without awareness, the silence is utterly empty and dark, dismal, sad. Silence can either be of the symmetry or of a sunrise. The silence can be of a bird on the wing, or it can be that of a corpse. Both are silences, but diametrically opposite. The silence of a corpse has to be avoided. The silence of a flower has to be imbibed. The silence of the flower will make you a flower. The silence of the corpse will make you a corpse. Both look from the outside the same. Don't be deceived by appearances. Always look for the essential, for the very core. Two things can appear similar from the outside and may be just the opposites of each other. The seeker has to be very cautious, very conscious on each step, because the false is easy to attain. It is very easy to become dead and very difficult to be overflowing with life. That's why millions of monks, nuns have followed the false path. They have become silent. You can go to the monasteries and you will find people who are silent, but their silence has the taste of death. Their silence is not the silence of a song, of a dance. Their silence is not divine. In fact, they have fallen rather than rising higher, soaring upwards. They have fallen so much they have become just dead rocks. Their silence has not been a transformation. It has been a suicide. And because it has not been a soaring high, you will find all kind of foolishnesses still hidden in it, waiting for their opportunity, for their moment to explode. The foolish person can become silent. It may deceive many. They may think he has arrived, but he is simply hiding his foolishness, his stupidity, his unconsciousness behind a beautiful facade of silence. An ancient Sufi parable says, four persons decided to go into silence. They moved into a cave. They wanted to live in silence for 3 months because they have heard so much about it. They had become so much intrigued. They were so much ambitious to gain something out of it. It was not understanding that has brought them to the cave. It was greed. It was desire, ambition. Hence, within minutes, everything was exposed. Just within minutes, the first man said, "I wonder whether I have put the candle out or not. It will be a sheer wastage. There is nobody in the house." The second one said, "You fool. You have spoken. And we have taken the vow of silence." The third one laughed and said, "You are a greater fool." If he had spoken, what was the need for you to speak? And the fourth one said, "Thank God, I am the only one who has not spoken yet." just by being silent, nothing changes. You remain the same. Transformation comes through awareness. Awareness brings a silence of its own, very alive, throbbing with eternity, full of a song. It is not sad and not serious, because it is not dead. It has a dance to it. It is tremendously beautiful. It is positive, existential. It does not make you just a hollow thing. It makes you so full that you start overflowing with joy. You become so fulfilled that you cannot contain your contentment to yourself. You have to share it. You become a cloud full of rainwater. You have to savor it. But out of 100 so-called seekers, it is only once in a while that a rare seeker comes to know the difference between the real silence and the unreal silence. How can the fool within you be dropped by being silent? Yes, it will not be expressed, but it will be there. In fact, it will become more and more powerful. Unexpressed, it will accumulate energy. And any moment, any opportunity, and you will sow it. You will be unable to hide it forever. It was discovered in an apartment building that exactly 50 apartments were rented by Jewish families and 50 by Christian families. Word got around, and thereafter for years, whenever a Jew moved out, the other rushed another Jew into his place, and likewise the Christians. Thus the balance was maintained. Once, however, the Jews were faster than the Christians, and the numbers became unbalanced, 51 to 49. After that, the Christians started moving out, until at last the building was 99% Jewish. A movement arose among the tenants for an all-Jewish building. A committee was formed, and Minister Ginsburg, as a spokesman, went to visit Mr. Gallagher, an Irish bachelor. When he came home, Mrs. Ginsburg asked what happened. "Well," replied Mr. Ginsburg, "Gallagher says he has made love to every woman in the building except one, and won't move out until he makes love to her." Mused Mrs. Ginsburg. "It must be that lousy, stuck-up Mrs. Pincus." The first moment, and your fool will be out. How long you can keep it down? How long you can sit upon it? How long you can be on guard, just a little relaxed, and it will be out. Buddha says, silence cannot make a master out of a fool. A strange statement from a Buddha, because silence has been praised so much. But the Buddha says the truth as it is. He does not care about the tradition. In India, silence is one of the most praised qualities for centuries. The Jaina monk is called Muni. Muni means the silent one. His whole effort is to be silent, more and more silent. Buddha says, but don't be a fool. Just silence is not going to help. It may keep your foolishness to yourself. But the foolishness will go on accumulating. And sooner or later, it will be too much. And it is bound to come out. And it is better to let it come out in small doses every day, rather than accumulating it first, and then it comes like a flood. This has been my own observation too. The people who have remained silent for long become very stupid. Because their silence is only on the surface. Deep down there is turmoil. Deep down they are the same people, with all greed, jealousy, envy, hatred, violence, with all unconsciousness, with all kinds of desires. Maybe now they are desirous of the other world, greedy for the other world, thinking more of paradise than thinking of this world and the earth. But it is the same thing projected onto a bigger screen, projected on eternity. In fact, the greed has become thousandfold. First it was for small things, money, power, prestige. Now it is for God, samadhi, nirvana. It has become more condensed and more dangerous. Then what has to be done? If silence cannot make a master out of a fool, then what can make one a master? Awareness. And the miracle is, if you become aware, silence follows you like a shadow. But then that silence is not practiced. It comes on its own accord. And when silence comes on its own accord, it has a tremendous beauty to it. It is alive. It has a song at its innermost core. It is loving. It is blissful. It is not empty. On the contrary, it is a plenitude. You are so full that you can bless the whole world, and yet your sources remain inexhaustible. You can go on giving, and you will not be able to exhaust the source You have stumbled upon God already, but it happens through awareness. That is Buddha's very significant contribution, his emphasis on awareness. Silence becomes secondary. Silence comes as a byproduct. One does not make silence a goal. The goal is awareness. If you take care of the rose bush, you give it the right amount of water, the sun and the sedge, roses are bound to come in their own time. You need not be worried about the roses. Silence is a rose. Awareness is the rose bush. You take care of the rose bush. Don't be too much concerned about the rose. If you are too much concerned about the rose without thinking about the rose bush, there is every possibility you will purchase some plastic rose flowers. A practiced silence is a plastic phenomenon. It is false, pseudo, deceiving others and deceiving yourself. Silence cannot make a master out of a fool. And what does Buddha mean by a fool? Who is foolish? He does not mean the unknowledgeable person. He does not mean the uneducated, uncultured. The fool can be very much cultured. The fool can have a PhD. The fool may have accumulated great knowledge, learning. In fact, the fools are known to do such things. For the simple reason, because he is afraid of his foolishness, he wants to cover it up. A PhD, a D.Litt becomes a good cover. He becomes a great philosopher, a great scholar. Instead of knowing, he becomes knowledgeable. Instead of seeing light, he knows more about light. And slowly, slowly, he convinces himself that knowing about light is knowing light. Knowing about God is knowing God. Knowing about love is knowing love. It is not so. He remains confined to the empty words. Verbose he will be. He may know fine words. He may use language skillfully. He may use logic to prove his ideology. He may be a skillful logician. But nothing of these things changes his foolishness. He remains a fool all the same. Then what is foolishness? The word that Buddha uses, the original word, is mūḍha, which has been translated as the fool. In fact, it should be translated as one who lives in unconsciousness. Who lives like a sleepwalker. Who lives mechanically. Who goes on moving through many things, but all his gestures are empty. He lives without knowing why. He goes on rushing without knowing where. He is not even aware who he is. He has not tasted his own consciousness. And because his inner being is in darkness, he remains. Foolish in whatsoever he tries to do. His knowledge, his learning, his scholarship are of no avail. One who lives unconsciously like a somnambulist is a fool. One who lives consciously starts changing from foolishness towards wisdom. Again, let me remind you, wisdom is not knowledge. Wisdom is consciousness. And the man who attains to the perfection of wisdom, perfection of consciousness, is called a master by the Buddha. Silence cannot make a master out of a fool. On his honeymoon, Abby was so overtaken with gratitude towards Becky that he wanted to give her something. Having nothing else at hand, he reached into his wallet and gave her $20. Thereafter, it became a family ritual. Each time Abby made love to Becky, he would give her some money, the amount varying according to how his business was going. Years passed, the depression came, and business got really bad. For weeks and months, Abby did not make love to Becky. Finally, in desperation, she asked, "Abby, what is the matter? Don't you love me anymore?" Abby told her the truth, that he was nearly bankrupt. "Don't worry, darling," she replied, and lifting up the mattress, she revealed thousands and thousands of dollars. "All the money you gave me, I put in the bed," she said. "Ah," he screamed, hitting his forehead, "I should have given you all my business." An unconscious man can't be always on his guard. There are moments when the secret comes out. You can deceive, but only for a time. You cannot deceive forever. Not at least your wife. And how can you deceive God Himself? How can you deceive existence? With existence you have to be absolutely true, because before existence you are utterly naked. Existence knows you through and through. You are transparent. It is better not to hide. Because if we don't hide, there is a possibility that we may start changing our life patterns, our ways, our styles. And there are only two styles. The one style is the unconscious, I call that the worldly style. And the other style is that of consciousness. My name for that style is sannyas. Sannyas simply means a committed effort to live consciously. But he who weighs only purity in his scales, who sees the nature of the two worlds, he is a master. Who is a master according to Buddha? He who weighs only purity in his scales. Remember always, with Buddha, purity is never a moral concept. He is not a priest. He is not a politician. He is a man who has gone beyond all dualities. The duality of good and bad included. Then what he can mean by purity? By purity he always means innocence. Just like a small child who knows nothing what is good and what is bad. The sage also becomes a child again. He goes beyond. Child is below. The child is below the duality, and the sage is beyond duality. One thing is similar, that both are not part of the duality world, of the world where everything is divided into polar opposites, good and bad, night and day, love and hate, life and death. This world and that world, the sinner and the saint. The sinner is one who knows what is good and what is bad, but follows the bad. The saint is one who knows what is good and what is bad, but follows the good. And the sage is one who knows what is good and what is bad, but has gone beyond both, and is no more interested in those divisions. He lives in a choiceless awareness. That is purity. To live without any choice means to let God live through you. If you choose, then you don't allow God to live through you. When you stop choosing, when you simply surrender to the whole, when you say, "Thy will be done," you are no more a chooser, no more a doer, you become only a medium. Then God lives through you. Then whatsoever happens is divine. It is neither good nor bad. It is simply divine. Out of choiceless awareness, actions become divine. He who weighs only purity in his scales, who sees the nature of the two worlds, this world and the other world, religious people go on talking about, they condemn this world. This is momentary. This is a flux. Nothing abides. Everything changes. Everything turns into dust. They go on condemning this world in every possible way, and they go on praising the other worlds. But Buddha says, this world and that world are both parts of your projection. You have projected the other world against this world. Because you see, this world is impermanent, so you project a permanent world. That is a desire on your part. It has nothing to do with reality. You would like to have a permanent world where things abide, where everything remains as it is. You are afraid of change. Hence you create an unchanging world. You call it paradise, heaven. Nothing changes there. Time exists not. This world is temporal. That world is non-temporal. This world is made of dust and that world is made of gold. But dust or gold are all your projections. It is out of the misery of this world that you have created your paradises. And if you look in the scriptures of all the religions, you can easily detect the projection. Whatsoever is missing here, you have placed it there. Whatsoever you don't like here, you have not put it in the other world. Whatsoever you like here, but you are afraid it will be taken away by death or by circumstances, you have made it absolutely eternal there. For example, in heaven, nobody ever grows old. Everybody remains young. Have you ever seen any old angel? Any picture? They are all boys looking. In Hindu mythology, the heavenly women never grow beyond the age 16. That is the desire. In Hindu mythology, the apsaras, the heavenly women, don't perspire. No deodorants are needed. No perfumes are needed. Their bodies are made of gold. But what kind of a woman, if her body is made of gold, would you be able to love a woman whose body is made of gold? A wish fulfillment. In Hindu mythology, there are trees in heaven. Wish fulfilling trees. You just sit underneath the tree and you wish anything and it is immediately fulfilled. Instantly. These are desires. Unfulfilled desires. Unfulfilled dreams. We are so frustrated here that we project a world. Karl Marx is right in that way when he says the religion is the opium of the people. Yes, the so-called religions have functioned as the opium. They keep people intoxicated with the other world. They help them somehow to tolerate the suffering that is present in this world. It is only a question of few days. then comes death and deliverance, and then you will live in God's presence forever and ever in eternal joy. Buddha never talks about the other world. He says this world and the other both are projections of our mind. One should get rid of both. One should turn in rather than looking outwards. This world is outside, that world is outside. Both are exterior to you, and both are objects of desire, and any object of desire is bound to bring frustration. Any expectation is bound to turn into frustration. Expectation is the beginning of frustration, the very seed. Beware of it. Buddha says one who knows this is a master, and one who lives in choiceless awareness, neither choosing this nor that, is a master. He is really a king. Otherwise, everybody is a beggar. If you have desires, you are a beggar. Desiring means begging. You are constantly begging for this and for that. Just look at your mind. The mind is the beggar. Drop the mind, and you will be surprised your consciousness is the master. But the mind lives through division. It always lives through the polar opposites. It puts that against this and then goes on choosing. Mind means choice. Choice means unconsciousness. Consciousness means choicelessness. And to be choiceless is to be free from all desire. Is to be free from all projection. Is to be free from all imagination. Is to be free from future. And the moment you are free from the future, suddenly the present bursts forth in all its splendor before you. Its glory is infinite. Its joy is unbounded. Its ecstasy is inexpressible. It transforms your beggar into a master. He harms no living thing. The master cannot be violent. He can only be love, pure love. He cannot harm. It is impossible. Why? Many religions have been teaching non-violence. Buddha does not teach non-violence. Again, it is a byproduct, a consequence of being a master. He does not say, be non-violent so that you can be a master. He says, be a master so that you can be non-violent. That's where he differs from ordinary religious thinking. He brings a very extraordinary insight of tremendous import. If you can understand his insight, you would have understood the essential core of real religion. If you practice non-violence, you will remain violent. At the most, your surface will become non-violent. You will paint it in beautiful colors. But behind it, behind all those rainbow colors, you will be the same person, the same violent person. Why violence exists in man? Because we can't see ourselves as part of a universe. We see ourselves as separate. In that separation is violence. If I am separate from everybody else, then of course I have to fight for my own survival. Charles Darwin says, life is a struggle. A struggle to survive. And only the fittest survive. So you have to fight tooth and nail. You have to fight with your total energy. Only then you can survive. Otherwise you will be eaten, destroyed. And if you look outside, it seems so. Politics proves Charles Darwin. Everybody is fighting with everybody else. And how you can be non-violent if you are continuously fighting? Man is so cunning that he can change, transform his non-violence also in a weapon. He can make a weapon out of it. He can start fighting non-violently. I have heard a story. A young man, a Gandhian, a follower of Mahatma Gandhi, was in love with a woman. The father was very much against. The woman herself was very much against the man. She hated even to see his face. But he was determined. He was a man of willpower. And he was very non-violent. So he did a non-violent trick. He went to the woman's house, sat on the door and declared that he will fast unto death unless she marries him. Very non-violent method. Fasting unto death. You are not harming anybody. That's what Mahatma Gandhi was doing his whole life. Fasting unto death. But is it non-violence? It is violence, pure violence. Of course you are not destroying the other. You are destroying yourself. But the threat that I will destroy myself is a threat of violence. And you leave the other absolutely undefended. The woman was very much perturbed, disturbed, what to do. If this man dies, she will feel her whole life guilty that she has been the cause of the death of a young man. The father was very much disturbed. And newspapers were talking and praising the young man that how non-violent he is, how Gandhian he is. The father was getting crazy, what to do, what not to do. Somebody suggested that you inquire some older Gandhian, some method must be there, some antidote. He went to an old Gandhian. He said, no, don't be worried. I know. You do one thing, a very simple thing. He whispered a secret in his ears. And the father was very happy. And the trick worked. The old Gandhian said to him, you go to an old prostitute I know. You tell her to come to your house, sit by the side of the young man, and let her declare that I am fasting unto death unless this young man marries me. And that very night the young man escaped and was never seen again. Non-violence in the hands of politicians is bound to become violent. It is only a beautiful name for an ugly phenomenon. This is not Buddha's approach. Although Gandhians go on declaring that Gandhi is the greatest non-violent man after Gautam Buddha, he is not. He has no understanding of Buddha and his insight. He is pure and simple a politician. His politics is also very subtle. His politics is very cunning, devious, but he is not religious at all. His whole approach is political. If you practice non-violence, and he practiced his whole life, non-violence will be false. It cannot be practiced. Anything non-violence, wisdom, silence, love, compassion, joy, nothing of these beautiful qualities can be practiced. If you practice them, you falsify them. They come on their own. All that you need to do is to be more and more aware. On the tree of awareness, many flowers bloom. The flower of love, the flower of truth, the flower of compassion, the flower of non-violence. Why? Because the more you become aware, the less you can believe in the separation. The more you are aware, the less you are an ego. When you become totally aware, you disappear. You become part and parcel of the whole. Then how you can be violent? To whom? There is nobody else. With whom you are going to fight? Violence is not the question at all. There is nobody else to fight with. It is all oneness. This whole universe is one God. We are part of it. Seeing it, knowing it, realizing it, compassion, love starts flowing. He harms no living thing. And yet it is not good conduct. Remember these words, their import, their significance. They are very pregnant. And yet it is not good conduct. Remember, Buddha is saying, I am not talking about good conduct. That helps you on the way. Good conduct can give you only respectability. Good conduct can help you to attain a pious ego. Good conduct will make people praise you. They will call you a saint. Your ego will be very satisfied. But good conduct can't help you on the way. In fact, it is going to hinder. The more respectable you become, the less rebellious you are. The more respectable you become, the more and more afraid of going against tradition, against conformity, against convention. The more respectable you are, the more you are a slave of the society and the church, a slave of the estate, a slave of others, because they start dominating you. They start in subtle ways telling you what to do and what not to do. They reward you with respect. That is a bribery. By rewarding you, they are saying, look, if you go on doing the same thing, we will reward you more. If you don't do the same thing, if you go astray, we will withdraw our respect. We will condemn you. They respect you for the simple reason that you fulfill their desires and their expectations. That you become just a part of the dead tradition, an example. Of all that has been dead for long, you become a slave to the past. And yet, says Buddha, it is not good conduct that helps you upon the way. Because your good conduct is only practiced by you. It has not arisen from your own innermost core. You are following the conditioning. You are following whatsoever has been forced upon you. If you are a Hindu, you will follow a certain conduct that Hindus expect of you. If you are a Mohammedan, you will follow certain other conduct which has been forced upon you. Ayatollah Khomeini, whose real name is Ayatollah Khomeiniak, he goes on telling to his followers that be martyrs, that we are martyrs, that if you die fighting for religion, you will be born into paradise. Jihad, religious war, is the surest way and the most easily available to reach to God. Every other way is a very long way. To die in a religious war is a shortcut. Now many people, mad people, are following this lunatic. Yes, he is Khomeiniac. But this has been always so. These maniacs, that these lunatics, fanatics, have dominated humanity. They go on promising you a beautiful future after death. It is a beautiful business because nobody comes back to say whether it really happens or not. It is dealing in invisible goods. You can have a good conduct according to a certain society, but you will remain still unconscious as you were before. By being a Mohammedan or a Hindu or a Christian, you don't become conscious. If you become conscious, you can't be a Hindu or a Mohammedan or a Christian. How can you be so foolish to be a Hindu, to be a Buddhist, to be a Jaina? Impossible. You will not have any adjective to you. You will be simply a human being, a divine being. That's more than enough. What else is needed? But following the so-called good conduct, you will remain the same unconscious person. Joe was out all night with a dazzling blonde. He came home at dawn and tried to appear quietly sober as his wife eyed him with suspicion. Joe, where is your underwear? She said as he was undressing. My God, he cried with aggrieved dignity, I have been robbed. Your whole life is lived in such an unconscious way. You can practice good things, you can do good things, service to people, you can donate in charity. You can even become a Mother Teresa of Calcutta. But your life will be the same. Yes, you will get a Nobel Prize. And you will be honored all over the world. The world consists of fools, and only the fools are honored. Just look at the irony. Jesus is crucified, and Mother Teresa is given a Nobel Prize. Socrates is poisoned, and Mother Teresa is given a Nobel Prize. Maharishi Raman was not given a Nobel Prize. J. Krishnamurti has worked his whole life as nobody has ever worked for a better human being, for a better conscious world, but he has not been given a Nobel Prize. Not even his name has ever been considered for it. George Gurdjieff was not given a Nobel Prize. Who was the greatest master who transformed few people's life into light? Mother Teresa is not a Raman Maharishi. She is not a J. Krishnamurti. She is not George Gurdjieff. But why she is honored? Because she fulfills your requirements. She serves beggars, orphans, widows. And that is your idea of a saint, that he should serve. He should serve all kinds of fools. Then he is a saint. Then other fools will respect him. You are unconscious, your expectations are unconscious, and there are people who will fulfill them. You will respect them. You will call them saints. Now Mother Teresa has no taste of awareness, no experience of ecstasy. But that is not the point for the people. The point is how many hospitals he runs, how many orphans he has raised. As if the world is already not too much populated. How many old people he serves? How many old people have survived through her efforts? These things have nothing to do with real religion. These are social services. She is really serving the status quo. That's why she is respected. The Nobel Prize is not given because she is religious or a mystic. The Nobel Prize is given because she serves the capitalist system. She serves the status quo. She serves the vested interests. She is not a revolutionary, but a reformist. She is not a rebel. Unless you become capable of seeing the beauty of rebellion, the beauty of a Jesus, Socrates, Buddha, you will not understand what real religion is. The tensions of life were threatening to get a stranglehold on Bill, and after he had finished a good dinner, he relaxed mindlessly in a soft chair next to the studio with a stiff drink in his hand. His wife knew nothing of his nervous state, and she climbed onto his lap with the thought of trying to wheedle a fur coat out of him, and snuggled and murmured and fondled. "Good heavens, Ethel," he exploded, "get off. I get enough of this at the office." You just watch yourself. What you say, what you do, what you hear, what you see, and you will be surprised that you are always surrounded by smoke. A subtle smoke surrounds you, and you see through that smoke, and everything becomes distorted. Buddha's simple message is that first be aware. He says, and yet it is not good conduct that helps you upon the way, nor ritual. Going to church every Sunday, doing your puja, your worship every morning, doing your prayer every night before going to bed. These are all rituals, dead rituals that you go on repeating. You have become habituated to them. They are just habits. If you don't do them, you feel as if you are missing something. If you do them, you don't gain anything at all. A man said to a psychiatrist, "Look, I have everything. I need a good house, a beautiful wife, successful children, a lovely job, but still my life is humdrum." "Well," said the psychiatrist, "you are suffering from too much routine. You must bring novelty in your life. When do you usually make love to your wife?" "Always at bedtime," replied the man. "That's the trouble. You are too settled. Try grabbing your wife passionately at some unusual time, fling off your clothes when you come into the house and get her. Then come back next week and report what happened." "So," said the psychiatrist the following week, "how was it?" "Well," replied the client, "the bridge club loved it, but it was still humdrum." Just by changing outer routine, nothing is changed either. You can go to the church, you can change. You can start going to a temple. You were repeating one mantra, you can change. You can start repeating another mantra. You were a member of the Lions Club, you can become the member of the Rotary Club. Christians become Hindus, Hindus become Christians. In the hope, as if by just changing outer forms, anything is going to be changed in their life, the inner remains the same. Unless the inner changes, your life is going to remain humdrum. And a humdrum life can never know the flavor of the divine, can never know the taste of the wine of God. Nor ritual, says Buddha, nor book learning. You can learn as much as you want. The psychologists say each single human brain is so capable of learning that it can accumulate all the knowledge contained in all the libraries of the world. A single human mind is capable of storing all the knowledge possible. You can become a walking Encyclopedia Britannica, but that is not going to help. You will know the words, but words are words. The word fire is not fire. Don't try to cook your food on the word fire. The word love is not love either. And the word God is not God. But people become so much obsessed with words. They become so much obsessed that if somebody says anything against the Bible, you are ready to be killed or killed. And Bible is just a word. The word Bible simply means the book. It does not mean anything else. If somebody says anything against the Vedas, Hindus become mad. Words have become so important, more important than your life. The whole history is full of blood and blood shed just because of words. Buddha says, beware. Don't get too much entangled in words. A Jewish mother was very unhappy because her son did not like blintzes. In desperation, she consulted a psychiatrist who suggested that if she sewed semi, step by step, how blintzes were made, he might come to love and understand them. Eager to try out the suggestion, she took semi into the kitchen the very next day. "Look, semi," she said, mixing the dough. "Eggs, milk, flour. You like eggs and milk and flour, don't you, semi? Taste a little." The little boy, with sour expression, grudgingly tasted a bit of each. She rolled out the dough and fried it into cakes. "Taste a little," she urged him, and again he tasted a bit, encouraged. She went on mixing the cheese and cinnamon and sugar. "Look, Semi, cheese, cinnamon, sugar, you like them, don't you, Semi?" "Yes, Mom," he replied. Really encouraged now, she placed the cheese mixture in the middle of a cake. Cautiously she folded over one corner. "Okay, Semi?" "Okay, Mom." Then she folded a second corner. "Okay? Okay." Then she folded the third corner and finally the fourth one. "Blintzes!" "Yeah!" screamed Semi and ran out of the kitchen. And it is not so only with children. It is so with your great theologians, philosophers, thinkers, just words. Buddha says, nor ritual, nor book learning, nor withdrawal into the self. Buddha must be the first enlightened master who has said this so clearly. Now modern psychology has rediscovered it. I say rediscovered it. They think they have discovered because they are not aware of Buddha's statement. They think that extroversion is a kind of disease. Buddha is exactly saying the same thing. He is saying nor withdrawal into the self. Extroversion is a disease, so is introversion. The real man of awareness is neither extrovert nor introvert. He simply is. When needed, he goes out. When needed, he goes in. And he is fluid, flexible. He is not focused and fixated. There are extroverts who can't go in, and there are introverts who can't go out. Both are ill. Both are pathological. Nor withdrawal into the self is going to help you on the way, nor deep meditation. Let me repeat, you will be surprised, because Buddha is one of the greatest meditators of the world. And Buddha is responsible for the greatest stream of meditation that has flowed up to now. He is the very source, but still, he is such a sincere man. He says, nor deep meditation. None of these confers mastery or joy. Why? Not even meditation. Because meditation is a method. Meditation can cause a certain state of the mind, but it cannot make you available the uncaused. It may prepare the ground. It may cleanse the grounds, but it cannot bring the flowers. It is like you prepare the ground for a garden. You remove all the rocks, all the weeds, all the roots, all the grass. You prepare the ground, but that's not enough. If you prepare the ground and then sit under the tree and wait for the roses to come, they will not come. Meditation is only a negative method. It helps you to prepare the ground. It removes the barriers. But then you have to sow the seeds. Only then flowers will be coming. Meditation is creating the ground. Awareness is sowing the seeds. Meditation with awareness can only help you on the way. And then there is mastery. And then there is joy. O seeker, rely on nothing. To make it absolutely sure that you don't rely on anything, he has said, and yet it is not good conduct that helps you upon the way, nor ritual, nor book learning, nor withdrawal into the self, nor deep meditation. None of these confers mastery on joy. But who knows? You may find something else. Hence, to make it absolutely clear, categorically clear, he says, O seeker, rely on nothing. Reliance on anything brings dependence. Dependence brings slavery. Slavery is misery. Don't depend. Not even on meditation. One day even meditation has to be transcended. Don't depend even on the master. Because the master can only point the way. You have to follow the path. The master cannot go with you. Buddha is reported to have said that if you meet me on the way, kill me. Even if I come in your way as a hindrance, kill me immediately. Don't have any hesitation that I am your master. How can you kill me? He is saying something very metaphorical. He is saying deep in meditation, the last thing to be dropped is the master. Everything can be dropped easily, but the more the master helps you to drop things, the more you become attached to the master himself. And the love for the master is so pure and so ecstatic. It brings such joy that it is very difficult to drop the master at the last moment. And the last moment is the last barrier. The master has to be dropped. You have to go alone, absolutely alone, into the unknown. Rely on nothing. Until you want nothing. Go on dropping your desires, even the desire for being a master, the desire for being blissful, the desire for knowing God, the desire for nirvana. All desires have to be dropped. Mind is so cunning, you can drop one desire, it immediately supplies you another. and it may supply you with a more subtle desire. The grass desire can be understood by everybody. The subtle desire is more difficult to understand. For example, the desire for God is not thought to be a desire worth dropping. No Christian will say, no Jew will say, no Mohammedan will say that drop the desire for God. Drop all desires for God, but don't drop the desire for God. It is only the Buddha, the only man in the whole history of human consciousness who has said the whole truth. Truth in its absolute purity. Truth and nothing else. He is so insistent on the truth that he says you will have to drop the master and you will have to drop all kinds of desires. Otherwise mind is very innovative, very creative, imaginative. You drop one thing, it immediately says, good, now seek this. Seek truth. Seek God. Now nobody can raise any objection about seeking God. Buddha raises objection for that too. After numerous complaints from the neighbors, Harry sadly agreed to have a veterinarian render his cat fit to guard a sultan's harem. I will bet, said one neighbor, that ex-tom of yours just lies on the hearth now and gets fat. No, he still goes out at night, but now he goes along as a consultant. If you cannot do anything, at least you can function as a consultant. But the going continues. Nothing has changed. The operation has failed. Remember, if you are a real seeker, and this is a strange paradox, if you are a real seeker, you will have to drop all seeking as such. Otherwise, you will go on seeking one thing after another, and there is no end to it. When all seeking stops, you are suddenly at the very center of your being. Seeking drives you outside. Seeking takes you away from yourself. Jesus says, seek and ye shall find. Knock and the door shall be opened unto you. Ask and it shall be given. Buddha will not say that. Buddha will say, seek and you will not find. Knock and the doors will be never opened for you. Ask and you will not be given. Then why Jesus says so? Is not Jesus a Buddha? Jesus is also a Buddha. But the difference of their statements consists because of the ideas. Jesus is talking to ordinary people, and Buddha is talking to very evolved disciples. Jesus is talking to the crowds. If he says to them, "Seek and ye shall never find," they would not have understood him. They would have thought him mad, absolutely mad. Seek and ye shall not find him. Ask and it shall not be given to you. Knock and the door shall not be thrown open unto you. He was talking to ordinary people, hence he had to use very ordinary expressions. Buddha is talking to adepts, initiates. Jesus was not so fortunate as Buddha. Jesus' disciples, too, were very ordinary. Even those 12 apostles were very ordinary, unconscious people. Buddha had thousands of bodhisattvas, thousands of disciples who were just on the verge of becoming Buddhas any moment, thousands who were just on the verge to burst into a flame of eternal light. He could talk without any fear of being misunderstood. Hence he says, rely on nothing until you want nothing. The greatest moment in life is when there is no desire left inside you, when desirelessness settles. Absolute desirelessness. In that very moment, all is attained. Because all has always been there inside you. It was because of desires you were running hither and thither, not looking inside. When all running has stopped, suddenly your own truth explodes with all its beauty, with all its benediction upon you. Listen to Buddha. Meditate over his sutra. It will give you great insight. Insight into desire and its futility will help you to drop all desires. And the moment you are desireless, you have arrived home. Enough for today.